Hey, this is Ari. Welcome back to the Energy Blueprint Podcast. With me today is Dr. Mel Hopper-Koppelman, who is somebody I really just sort of stumbled across. We became Facebook friends. I'm not even sure how. And I started reading her posts out of the blue and became really fascinated and impressed with some of her thinking about health, and kept reading more and more of her stuff, and continued to be very impressed by her original and very novel way of thinking about health. She has a background in all kinds of things, from nutrition to functional medicine, to traditional Chinese medicine, to functional developmental behavioral neuroimmunology, and many, many other fields. She's really a very, very widely read student, geek of health science. And she knows a lot about a whole lot of dimensions of health science. And what really most excites me is she's somebody who thinks about health in novel ways, is really trying to put together different models, different scientific evidence and research, and piece together new insights and ways of understanding and approaching health and attacking health problems. So with no further ado, I'm very excited to share this conversation, part one of what will be a multi-part discussion with Dr. Mel Hopper-Koppelman. Enjoy. Mel, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I don't know how we connected on Facebook, but somehow we did, maybe 6 months or a year ago or something like that. And in my feed, I started seeing posts from yours. And I think I saw one and I read it, which is not common for me because I don't really spend much time on Facebook. I read it and I was very intrigued and impressed by some of the things that you were saying. Your perspectives, more than anything to me, struck me as novel. You struck me as an original thinker who was thinking outside the box, who wasn't just another one of the typical sort of run-of-the-mill natural health or functional medicine types that was regurgitating whatever the latest thing you learned at from your certification or the latest seminar or something like that from someone else, but you were really involved in thinking originally and coming up with your own ideas and developing your own paradigm. And I saw more of your posts, and I saw more of the same and more of the same and more of the same. And I've come to really respect and admire a lot of the perspectives that you have. And I do this podcast, I think 50-50, in part because I want to share your knowledge with my audience. And the other 50% is my own personal curiosity, wanting to explore your paradigms more deeply myself because they're of interest to me. And I like the way you think. And in general, I like the people who are trying to think in original ways, you know? So with that said, here we are. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I've been a longtime viewer of your podcast, and so it's very exciting for me to be here.
Awesome, awesome. So let's start at the meta level. I'm a huge fan, as I think you are, of paradigm and understanding the importance of paradigm as the key thing that will determine how we understand a particular problem, or how we understand health and longevity and energy and things of that nature more broadly. And based on how we understand the nature of those things, what we are inclined to do to build health or to solve health problems. So with that said, and I know this is a difficult ask because you'd like to go deep, but can you give our audience a sort of relatively succinct high level, sort of meta level summary of your big picture view paradigm of health?
Sure, I can try. I think the key is really trying to identify first principles of how things work, and so that you can apply them to the problem that you're trying to solve. And in my case, it's trying to help people recover their health, or help me recover my health, or to understand if something's likely to be helpful or not. And so, so in terms of, you know, first principles or things that are just going to always be accurate. And what I've found is that, you know, throughout my journey, my professional journey, my health journey, I was able to find some really great ideas, and maybe they were more helpful than the status quo. But when I would bump up against areas where they weren't working, you know, and say, well, what about this exception? Or what about this person? Or what about then? It was hard to find answers. And so it required me to find kind of bigger and bigger maps or different maps and figure out how to put them together. So, you know, first principles thinking, which I think is fairly in vogue now, it just means that it's the underlying kind of basis of how things work. It tends to be quite simple. It tends to be true whether you're aware of them or not. And it helps you kind of describe the context of what you're trying to do. So when something's going to work and when it's not.
Okay. And what are first principles, maybe for people who are unfamiliar with that term?
It's sort of the kind of the simplest basis of understanding something, whether it's a person or a machine or a problem, that when you kind of, we might start off with the details, or we might start off with what we can see. And that's an example. But when you kind of keep zooming out and you keep asking questions, the first principles are going to be like, this is how it always works, you know, and these are, and if you find an exception, then you might need to kind of rethink what you thought you understood about that system. So to give you some kind of concrete examples, because I think a lot of confusion in health comes from us being really kind of focused on the microscopic, right? Which is not really where the first principles live. Like, the microscopic exists and it can be helpful sometimes, but the first principles kind of exist really where the things that we can see, like, you know, to be honest, one field that provides a lot of like really helpful understanding and information is looking at things ecologically, ecology. So with ecology, you'd be thinking about temperature, for example. Is something hot or cold? Is something dry or moist? You know, is something kind of bright or dark? Really, really simple. But that gives you a lot of really useful big picture information, and those things are always going to be relevant and true, right? So, you know, life evolved on Earth on a sunny planet with water and soil. So we're kind of getting, again, at some first principles, and those things are always going to be true, and they're always going to be relevant. And so, you know, one thing I found when I got very stuck in the weeds of biochemical pathways is that if you can't bring back what you're looking at to kind of those things I just mentioned, like, you know, light and temperature and soil, you might not understand it as well as you hope.
I absolutely love the last part of what you just said there. Something that's a thought I don't think I've ever heard anyone else express, but it's something that I've really zeroed in on, especially in my recent writing for my upcoming book, as being of central importance. I would pretty much classify all, and I don't want to be mean here or sound like I'm opposed to conventional medicine or something like that, because I'm very appreciative of many aspects of conventional medicine, emergency medicine and antimicrobial drugs and things like that, and many other areas. However, I would put most of conventional medical thinking and the conventional medical approach to chronic disease in the category of what you just described there as being fixated on in the weeds of biochemistry and not linking it back to some of these first principles. For example, I mean, the conventional medical paradigm isn't grounded in a paradigm of evolutionary biology and evolutionary health, right, which is not just a small flaw, it is a fundamental flaw. In my view, you cannot understand health without looking at it through an evolutionary lens. And I think that has a lot to do with those first principles you're describing. But I also think that there's a huge amount of people in natural health and functional medicine circles who are also in the weeds of biochemical pathways who are not linking it back to first principles.
I would agree with that. And I definitely myself made the same error, you know, for many years. That's kind of how I've ended up where I am, because it can be fun to study those pathways and it's interesting and it's not irrelevant, and there's kind of a fun trail there. But I think part of it is that when we get into lab testing, we're getting into quantification, and that gives us a certain level of certainty. And we all have a need for certainty. Mm-hmm. And it can, you know, calm fears, and it can make us feel confident. And especially as a clinician, you know, you're trying to do the best for your patients. And in people, you know, especially with complex chronic illness, they've got layers of things going on. They've got mixes of patterns. You know, it's confusing. And so if you can use numbers, it feels like it's grounding. It gives you this, I would say, an illusion of grounding, where you can point to something with certainty. The problem is, because it is really divorced from the first principles, it's a false sense of certainty, and it's not grounded. It's actually very disembodied. And, you know, another, I think, kind of thread of what you were saying about how, you know, mainstream medicine is very, and a lot of, you know, functional medicine and integrative medicine, I think, is maybe a little too over enamored with lab tests, is that not only is it completely divorced from an understanding of evolutionary biology, but part of the fundamental premise is that they intentionally remove context in studying it. So evolutionary biology is, like, let's say, the meta context. It's like the key context. And a double blind placebo controlled randomized trial is coming from a worldview where we are stripping away context in order to study something, even though context actually provides most of the impact of what you were studying. Mm. Right. So it's almost like a mental health problem in the research literature at large, you know, that is, like, kind of not, you know, most people aren't aware of. They just kind of go in and they read, not realizing that this is, you know, based on some, like, pretty big flaws before we sat down to do our research.
Yeah. I love the way you just explained that. Let's explore this lab testing thing more deeply. Because I feel like it's an area where so few people really understand what you were just alluding to there, both within the general population and, I think, among practitioners. I think that there are huge numbers of practitioners, as well as the general public, who have been indoctrinated into the idea that when we use these tests, when we look at a blood panel, a comprehensive blood panel, comprehensive hormone panel, and organic acids tests and microbiome tests, and whatever other kind of tests you want to run, food allergen tests and so on, food intolerance tests, that we are getting a really, really comprehensive view of human health and what's going on in the body. That all of this data, like, what I think we imagine that we are looking at the totality of what can be measured in the body, and we have this really complete picture of all the physiology that and biochemistry that's happening inside that body. And I think what's become more and more apparent to me is two dimensions. One is that many of these tests are actually highly inaccurate. And you and I have had previous discussions. For example, I shared some of my microbiome tests with you from three different companies, and you could see mass disparities from literally the same fecal sample in what these different tests were saying was present in my microbiome or not present in my microbiome. I mean, massive differences. Yeah. So which tells you, okay, well, what does any of this data mean? How do I know I can trust any of this data, or any of it is giving me any sort of legitimate information? Whereas if you only looked at one of those tests, your brain would be inclined to think, well, this is exactly what's going on in my microbiome. Yeah. And you wouldn't have those two other sets of data to make you go, oh, I wonder if that first test was actually totally inaccurate. And none of that stuff should be trusted. That's one dimension, is realizing how widespread the issue of inaccuracy and lack of repeatability of these tests are. And the second dimension is realizing that there's so much more going on in the body than even what these tests are mentioning. And it's like, I'm trying to think of the proper analogy to express this, but, like, imagine you had a giant, let's say, mountain, you know, covered in trees, covered in a forest, and you had a spotlight, and it was at night, and you had a spotlight on just the bottom right section of this, and you saw a group of 10 or 15 trees, And you were like, okay, now we understand everything that's present here, but you were missing 90% of the mountain that's there. And you were convinced that this little piece of the forest was the entirety of what's there. You know, that's kind of what I feel like is going on. But what's your take on this?
Oh boy, you're touching on a subject that's very close to my heart. And again, this is coming from, you know, very hard won personal experience of doing lots of lab testing, doing lots of study. You know, I did a kind of a 6-month internship on one lab that was a metabolomics lab. That's 200 markers. And we were just focused on that. And 90% of the information or the interpretation is not even written on the report. And then I'm going off into PubMed. So believe me when I say it's, you know, there are layers and layers and layers of false assumptions that lab testing is based on. And once you start to see them, because they're not, it's not that tricky, you know, I can explain quite a few of them, then you start to shrug your shoulders and go, what's the point? And just to kind of say, I haven't completely abandoned lab testing, but I mean, it's just not the cornerstone of my practice anymore. And they need to be used with an abundance of caution.
They're not being used with an abundance.
They are not. No, they're being used with this sense of certainty. And
yes,
you know, I want to make sure that I say that the antidote to that is being able to learn how to see with your eyes better, you know, because a lot of people don't have a better alternative, you know, that if they're coming to functional medicine from, let's say, mainstream medicine, then that's maybe even a step in the right direction. If they're coming to functional medicine from other clinical areas where they haven't been taught how to gather tons of information by kind of looking and smelling and listening and all of those things, then they're kind of flying blind a little bit, and the lab testing is what they have. But let me give you some examples to illustrate, you know, some of the problems. So one comes from this really great paper. It was written by the European Scientific Committee, I think around 2015, but there was this group that was put together to basically answer the question for the European government, are dental amalgams safe? Mercury fillings, right? And this committee of scientific experts concluded that they absolutely were not safe. The European government completely ignored them and continued to recommend them. So this group published this position paper that really everyone should have a copy of because it's written really well. And they summarized the data. And one of the things that they say is that not only is body burden of mercury, and the way you determine body burden of mercury is on autopsy. You have a dead person and you have to, that's the way to measure mercury in a person. So obviously we don't want to do that for our patients or for ourselves, but so body burden is like linearly correlated with the number of amalgams that you have and the length of time you've had them. But body burden of mercury is not at all correlated with blood levels of mercury, hair levels of mercury, or urine. There's no relationship, which is like, you know, absolutely mind blowing. I run mercury tests in my clinic. I tend to run a tri-test where you're taking samples from blood and urine and hair. And, you know, and this is the most accurate test on the planet. I still believe it, aside from autopsy, of course, it is the most accurate. And it's not.
Why don't you just take it on autopsy?
I know. It's a tough sell. I've been having trouble.
Most accurate way. Just do that.
I'm like, most accurate way. I was having trouble with the marketing and then repeat custom. You know, so there's no relationship between the amount in the blood in the blood and in your brain and kidneys and bones, which is where it's ending up. And that's not a small point, you know, that's a big point. And so what it's telling us is that what's happening in the blood is not always not enough people are asking this question. What is the relationship between what is in the blood and what is in the body? We maybe don't know the answer to that. You know, another example is that there's an inverse correlation between the amount of calcium in your hair and the amount of calcium in your arteries, right? So direct inverse relationship. So that's not a small problem. Another not so small problem is where reference ranges come from, right? So in, you know, conventional industrial medicine, reference ranges will tend to be where 95% of the population falls. That population is the population of a specific lab. So just like with your poo being sent off to different labs, if you send your blood off to different labs, they should be coming up with the same numbers, ideally, but how they classify that, whether that's normal or high or low is actually going to be very different. So that's going to determine if, you know, whether or not you end up on medication, that sort of thing. So that's kind of crazy. And then what I've found over the years is that functional medicine's answer to that is to just tend to use more narrow ranges, you know? So they're basically like, oh, this 95% thing's too big. Let's just go here. But from my perspective, that's not evidence-based either.
Yeah.
And really the, you know, if we're going to try to do this, then what I propose is that we should be using very large samples, you know, studies based on large samples that are calculating usually all-cause mortality and see where the risk is lowest. And those exist for a number of markers. And what you find is that it doesn't correspond to the industrial medicine range and doesn't really correspond to the functional medicine range. And to add another layer is that for most markers, they really should be different for men and women. And that's also not a small point, you know, because it's not. So basically, if we're not understanding where it should be, then we can't really say if it's good or not, if we're not accurate there. So that's another problem, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think what you said about some of these, looking at the relationship between some of these markers and mortality, it's also become apparent to me that so many of the markers that are being looked at don't even have any data as it pertains to mortality. And yet they're being portrayed with this kind of grand sense of importance, like, oh yeah, like we have, there's an assumption built in other words, that just because you ran a test and you got back some data and you found some abnormality, that abnormality must be really important and must be in some way related to maybe your symptoms. Whereas I think the reality is, if we were able to, going back to that analogy that I gave, if we were able to measure all of that mountain, we would probably find, if there's one abnormality present, if we measured lots more stuff, if we have the capability to, like, let's say the more next generation of testing with metabolomics testing, we'd probably find dozens of abnormalities in many different systems of the body.
100%. And really what we're finding is that our understanding of cellular biology is changing based on metabolomics, and that, you know, I know that you're a big fan of Bob Navio's work, as am I. He's, you know, great, great thinker. He has an encyclopedic knowledge of you know, metabolomics, of pathways, of genetics, and all sorts of things. And so what you find is that you get these global changes. So metabolomics is a way of kind of measuring changes of everything at the same time. But what's really interesting and exciting is that when you look at that, what you're seeing is actually, wait for it, the changes in hot and cold, winter and summer. And, you know, so there's increasing amount of metabolomic studies being done on, for example, Chinese herbs, which are classified by temperature, amongst other things. And when you look at hot herbs, they increase summer metabolism. And if you look at hot patterns, it, usually in mice, it's the same thing. And if you look at cold patterns, it's the reverse. And so they, you know, they were zoomed in on these individual markers, you know, maybe they, you know, people were running dozens or hundreds. Well, we've got like 20,000 proteins, you know. Then people are looking at metabolomics, like, you know, I was looking at an ion panel with 200 markers, thinking, if I just keep looking at this, I'll know exactly what to give a patient. And I'm looking at like fatty acid pathways, and I'm looking at them, you know, I'm like driving myself crazy. Yeah. I'm like, okay, you're missing this cofactor, and this is happening. And there isn't an understanding of really the bigger picture is that the cell danger response is an exaggerated summer metabolism.
Let me, Mel, can we, before we get into summer and winter metabolism, which I think will require some greater explanation to our audience for people to get where you're going with that, let's jump back one step to just this thing you were just alluding to with going down this vast complexity of analyzing these biochemical pathways. I personally feel like that pursuit is endless. The level of complexity is endless. And we are, like, every day there's more layers to that story emerging. And I feel like it's a legitimately impossible task for any human to really master that level of in-depth biochemistry of so many different mechanisms. But more importantly, what I've found in doing the kind of thing that you were just describing is like analyzing this and that pathway, and then, okay, based on this understanding, it's a quick digression. When you actually delve into this on in a very detailed level, especially some of the more emerging pathways and things like that, you realize that there's conflicting views. Like there's different studies that find different things, and not every study is even showing the same consistent finding. But let's ignore that aspect of things. Let's just say we have clarity on all this complicated biochemistry, and we start thinking along the lines, which is really sort of an allopathic way of thinking, that when we understand things at the most micro level possible, here's this biochemical mechanism, here's the dysfunction present in it, that when we can intervene on that micro level of biochemistry of, oh, this pathway must be dysfunctioning, so if only we add this chemical, this synthetic chemical or this natural chemical, either a drug or a supplement, let's say, that it will change the biochemistry of this pathway and alter and fix the dysfunction that's present. I have explored that in such great depth over such a long time, and I have found it so lacking, so ineffective, so like that there is no, there is almost no correlation between the degree of of in-depth biochemistry knowledge that a person has and the level of results of how much they can help you improve your health. And if anything, there might be, if we include conventional medicine in the mix, there might be an inverse correlation.
I would say probably an inverse correlation. I think what's important to remember is that there are genetic diseases.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There are inborn errors of metabolism. There are genetic diseases where you have a single point mutation, where you have a typo in the genetic code, and that leads to an illness you can see with your eyes. So that's bottom-up causation. The problem is that just because that exists doesn't mean that's usually the case. And actually, that's like the rare, rare exception. But that's the thinking that's being applied to everything, you know, or to everyone. And so this is the problem that people need to remember. It's not that it's never true. Yeah. It's that it's sometimes true, but usually not, you know?
Yes. And just to put numbers on that, to make it even more concrete, it's less than 1% of illness that are true genetic illnesses. Yeah. And over 80% of the chronic disease burden are diseases of nutrition and lifestyle.
Exactly that. So just so people have that kind of context and awareness is that, you know, I think what kind of the bigger meta problems in modern times is that people are not, it's tricky to know when something is true. People want to know if it's true. Mm-hmm. And things are usually true sometimes, right? Yeah. So it's not that people are wrong. It's just more about understanding the context.
Right.
You know?
So I agree with that. And thank you for adding that. Let's say and this is generally the assumption that I'm talking about, is that we're talking about the 80% plus of the chronic disease burden that are generally caused by lifestyle factors. Within that, which are the major killers, things like heart disease and cancer and dementia and obesity and diabetes and so on, and many more, even things like sarcopenia and frailty and death by accident are largely mm-hmm. related to this. Within that, I find specifically that the pursuit of trying to correct dysfunctional biochemical pathways is highly ineffective. Yeah.
Completely agree. And like you say, it may have no correlation with outcomes, and it may have an inverse correlation with outcomes. And it's really a matter of being too zoomed in on, you know, on a pine needle on that tree in that corner that you were looking at. And, you know, one of the things that I notice, because I you know, in my studies, I continue to see what's being taught in functional medicine. And part of my journey, you know, after I studied Chinese medicine, I knew I wanted to do an internal medicine, and I kind of nerdy and into, you know, biochemistry. And my mom was a medical doctor and a medical researcher. And my grandfather was a chemist, and his brother was a chemist, a top chemist at Yale, and all this. So I kind of wanted to do that. part of my course correction and going down that path and kind of seeing that there's no there is then swinging back to, you know, what I was kind of talking about before about ecology, you know, and the kind of the metaphor I use is like, you know, I'm not a gardener yet. I want to become a gardener, but I'm not a gardener, but I know that when gardeners look at land, they are able to get a lot of information just by looking, right? That we're like, oh, how do you know that? Are you a witch? It's like, well, no, I can just see, right? Whereas me, I can't do that. And so, you know, if we're not using that power of just observation and common sense and our ability to see with our eyes, it's like we're running in and just like doing a soil sample and then trying to base all of our decisions on that. And so perfect. Where I've kind of swung back, I suppose solutions to this problem is, you know, first is to learn how to use our senses and become embodied and be able to gather that information. And it's not esoteric and it's not kind of woo-woo. It's actually, you know, when we study those ways of knowing, they're actually very, very sound. So if we're using, for example, our sense of smell to get information about a patient, they are now analyzing the aerobiome coming off of people and how that correlates to their skin microbiome and to the chemicals coming off of it. So it's just somebody who's trained their nose to be able to detect that and get useful, which is really helpful. There's nothing kind of woo about it, you know? And so the course correction there, if we're not using microscopic information to make all of our decisions, is, you know, that I'm kind of increasingly falling in love with herbs, which work at this level. And so herbs are... With using herbs,
okay,
with this ecological understanding, to me is the antidote to using individual synthetic nutrients to try to manipulate these pathways. That if we can see that someone's hot, we can use herbs that help the body to get rid of heat. And if we see that someone's damp, which a lot of people are, which is like having biofilms and dysbiosis and candida overgrowth, we can use herbs that help clear that, which is just a little bit different than using herbs that are antimicrobial, you know, because those are still looking at that reductionist level, and they're kind of, sometimes they're a mismatch. And so there's this kind of added context that's missing again. So that's, you know, I think part of what keeps people moving in this direction is they don't have somewhere to go.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's assume that the listener has no familiarity with traditional Chinese medicine and that model of health and these terms that you've used a couple times now of if someone's hot or cold or damp or summer metabolism versus winter metabolism. Mm-hmm. Begin to explain that to the audience in a way that you know speaks to them as though they haven't the slightest degree of knowledge on any of that terminology and what any of that means.
Well, I can do that, but what I want to also point out is that what the beauty of it is that they do have an understanding of this. This is innate. Like you already know what I'm talking about, not because of any sort of specialized knowledge. You know, this is knowledge that illiterate grandparents, you know, in different cultures have. It doesn't require a degree. It doesn't require PubMed. Children understand this. And so I want to kind of point that out. I want to tie it into what you already know, that you kind of, you know, most people know that if they are hot, their heart's going to be beating faster, even if they're not a doctor or an acupuncturist or a naturopath. And so it's really about reclaiming things that are obvious, because part of the problem of a system of medicine that intentionally reduces context, removes context from study, is also creates a little bit of a war on common sense, and basically says, you think you know this because that's what you see, but actually often what you see isn't true. And so you don't really know better anyways. And that's a fallacy. And we've got like all these Greek and Latin, you know, fallacies to throw at you. And that's why we're going to do this randomized study to find out what's really going on. And that's a big mistake. And so if you are a person at home with no medical training, you might want to reclaim things that you already knew to be true and were kind of told that you didn't have any right to know, that everything is specialized knowledge. And so, you know, so yeah, so when I say summer metabolism, let's, you know, direct our attention to things that you already know, like in summer, if you go outside, you know, depending on where you are in the world, there's going to be more activity. You know, the plants are going to be out. They're not going to be dormant. There's going to be things kind of move a little bit faster. It tends to be brighter and lighter. It tends to be warmer, you know? So this is, it's really in many ways, not more complicated than that. You know, now we're back to first principles again. In the winter, it's darker, it's colder, it's stiller, you know, it's more frozen. It's all of these things. And so we can tie this back to, you know, this is kind of our birthright. This is sort of what's going on, whether we're connected with it or not, you know, and whether we are aware of it or not.
So concretize that further and say, what would a person who's more in summer metabolism look like? What kinds of signs or symptoms might they exhibit, or personality traits? And the same for being in a winter metabolism. And is that as saying hot versus damp?
Those are really, really great questions. Summer and winter are kind of more natural timing. So they're happening. If someone's hot, that may or may not be appropriate. And damp, again, you know, it depends if it's appropriate for the timing. So what might you see in summer? In summer, people tend to be more energetic, you know, overall. They tend to be more social. They, you know, tend to move around more, and there's more warmth. So, and then in winter, you get the opposite. So what I was starting to kind of allude to before is that we have this cycling, or there is this cycling going on that we're kind of on the ride along for the ride for. So every 24 hours, the sun goes up and the sun goes down, right? So we have day and night. And then every year, every trip the Earth makes around the sun, we have, you know, depending on, you know, where you are in the world, you have summer and winter. So if we look at what can go wrong, when Bob Navio is talking about the cell danger response, and which is a three-step process that any cell goes through if it's injured or infected or stressed, what he's found is basically this is like a bigger amplitude or a bigger summer response, inflammation, right? So you have warmth and then you have fire, you know? So it's big warmth, it's big fire. And so if that goes on for too long, you get damage. And then conversely, we can also get stuck in winter. And this is something I would also, you know, love to talk about, because people who are stuck in winter are the people who tend to get missed by everyone. And so this is, they're not inflamed, they're under-inflamed, they're not aging too quickly, they're maybe aging too slowly. You know, and they will tend to be told by conventional medicine that, like, they're really healthy, like their blood pressure is nice and low, you know, their heart rate's nice and low. And meanwhile, you know, they're depressed, they have no memory, they can't poop, you know, and all this stuff. So this
is like the typical maybe chronic fatigue syndrome case.
Exactly right. It very well could be. So that's someone who's, and again, going back to natural principles, sometimes when we look at first principles, I've found, and I don't know if this is kind of true for you or in general, sometimes it's easier to understand things if I look at an animal versus humans, you know, mm-hmm. One thing that happens in nature is that some animals hibernate, you know, and that happens in winter, and that's a different physiology, you know, and so part of that physiology, things slow down, blood flow to a lot of different parts of the brain slow down. We're not optimized for standing up. So what happens in chronic fatigue? In chronic fatigue, which is like a little bit, you know, people can be different within that umbrella, but a lot of problems happen from like not being able to stand up or sit up. Mm. Why is that? Because the platform has gone into hibernation mode, you know, and that's really what's happening. So again, we've zoomed out. We start at the chemistry. It's really confusing. And in general, if we start in looking at the microscopic, we're not going to find the patterns by starting there. We do actually need to start with some understanding. And the fact is that we all do have some understanding. We've just been told we're not allowed to use it when we're studying things, which is maybe a little bit of a mistake. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what else should people understand about summer and winter metabolism? And what are the keys to, well, you know what, maybe we'll go here if this might help to add another layer to it. So you've mentioned Dr. Navio's work, the cell danger response. How does that overlay with the idea of summer metabolism and winter metabolism?
So I believe, well, I was going to say, I believe, but he's written it in his paper. So in his, I think it was his first paper on the cell danger response in 2014, it was before he had discovered these three distinct steps with these checkpoints. And what he had discovered was a summer and winter metabolism. So I think that sometimes that gets a little bit left out because it's not highlighted in his newer papers, but it's definitely part of his current understanding. Mm-hmm. So the cell danger response, which is based on looking at, you know, how thousands of metabolites move, you know, choreographed by the mitochondria, it's kind of a biochemical rediscovery of summer and winter, hot and cold. We're back to first principles again.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so let's say someone is stuck in, let's say someone's prone to being overly hot and being in summer metabolism. What would be good for them?
That's a great question. I'm gonna reframe this a little bit, actually, if okay. That's okay. So one of the places where I feel like, you know, because everyone, there's so many people out there doing such great work, right? Where we need to zoom out is that functional medicine and industrial medicine is pretty much only focused, and they are missing all the people stuck in winter.
Say it one more time. Functional medicine and industrial medicine are only focused on?
So functional medicine and industrial medicine are pretty much only focused on excess summer metabolism, inflammation, right? So they are saying everyone's inflamed. And when we looked at the most common diseases, what you kind of rattled off, obesity, cancer, you know, all these inflammation, these are all excess summer metabolism. So all of the advice that's being put out there for everyone is really for that group. It's all that kind of anti-inflammatory stuff and, you know, breathe slowly and, you know, de-stress and all of that stuff. And really who I kind of more want to speak to, because they're the people who are getting missed, are the people who are stuck in winter metabolism, because those are the folks who are being told that their blood pressure is nice and low. And they're also being told all of your problems are caused by inflammation. So you should be taking curcumin and whatever the kind of general recommendations are, even to the point, actually, I'd say, like, there's a lot of researchers out there that are focused on longevity, which is interesting. It's an interesting time to be alive. And I would say that all of the findings for increasing longevity are pushing people away from summer metabolism towards winter metabolism. And to kind of give you an interesting example of how that can go maybe a little bit too far, recently in Siberia, due to some thawing, they found a worm, like a nematode, that was 42,000 years old, that reanimated.
Wow.
So that's a 42,000 year old animal that's alive right now. That's winter metabolism, right? That, talk about longevity. And so the kind of the blind spot, there's an assumption, well, increasing longevity is good. We've discovered that we can increase longevity if we do this, therefore everyone should do this, and this is a good thing. But if you have someone who's watching and their blood pressure is low and they tend to be cold and they're trying to do all these things to help themselves, if they follow that advice, they're likely to feel worse. And it's really hard to find anyone to explain why.
Hmm. Yeah, very interesting. Personal anecdote, I'm wondering if you might have some insight into. When I moved down to Costa Rica several years ago, I started getting this weird thing on my hands where I would have little blisters that would come up, particularly between my fingers and to some extent on the palms of my hands, a bit on my, in between my toes as well, nowhere else in my body. And after a while, it's actually something I've had on and off since I was a kid. I remember seeing these little bumps on my fingers when I was a little kid as well. And eventually I realized that this was something called dyshidrotic eczema. And it only really flared up after I moved to Costa Rica. And I spend a lot of time outdoors, in the sun, at the beach, surfing, and it's hot here, hot, obviously hot tropical sun, playing tennis and doing other activities outdoors, and working out as well in the gym. And I spent like 2 years in pursuit of trying to figure out what the hell is causing this thing on my hands. And I explored all kinds of things. Maybe it's food intolerance. Maybe I'm allergic to eggs or dairy or something like that. Maybe it's something to do with my gut microbiome. That's what prompted me to do all that gut microbiome testing. I did comprehensive labs of all kinds to figure out if there was something going on in me that could explain this. All the functional medicine doctors I spoke to had no idea what was causing it or how to fix it. And after like years of being frustrated with that avenue and trying to figure out, like running so many different experiments, what the hell is causing these symptoms on my hands, these little blisters, I discovered something really interesting, which is that the most effective thing for me to do to eliminate it is a cold plunge. And that when I cool my body, particularly when I'm overheated, like after playing tennis for 2 hours in the hot sun, if I go into a cold plunge, and if I put my hands in the cold plunge, especially if I maybe even do that a couple more times a day for a minute or two, and if I air condition my office during the hours I'm in here, as opposed to allowing the hot air from outside in and sort of just being in here and sweating, it completely goes away and seems to be a function of literally being too hot in my body, that my body starts getting these little blisters in the palms, and particularly the hot part of my hand. It's also something people who are genetically prone to sweating a lot through the palms of their hands, which I am, are more prone to this condition. And being in a hot climate or being in the summer makes you more prone to this condition. Also getting it in the wet and dry, like going in the ocean and then drying out, or going in the pool, which I'm also doing very frequently, those two things. So I have like the perfect storm of factors to generate this condition. But I figured out how to completely eliminate it by essentially just cooling my body down for a period of the time and not being overly hot, which is, I think, lines up very much with what you're describing here.
100%. So you're using a kind of a first principles based, sometimes the other term I use, which maybe might be a little bit confusing to people, is sort of like physics based. But what I mean by that is like at the level of like, you know, humans, where we're just like looking at like, you know, up and down and hot and cold, just simple, really, you know, simple, that you've found a solution that's based on temperature, which is going to have an effect on your blood flow and on kind of the inner systems of your body and how it warms and cools itself. And also that the trigger is climate, mm-hmm. which a lot are, you know, there are certain things where, you know, not, this isn't a panacea, but for some people who are ill, if they kind of move to a different climate, they would be well. And yeah. You know, and that's not always possible, and that's not always the case. But also, what I want to kind of quickly say as well, though, is that it doesn't follow that everyone's going to benefit from a cold plunge. And that's like, you know, this sure. other layer that I see, because there are people out there who basically say that everyone should do it. And going back again to these people who are stuck in winter metabolism, oh boy, they're going to feel worse. And another piece of context is that, you know, I love the way that you're using the cold plunge because you're in Costa Rica. You're outside in the hot, you know, hot dev. It's likely going to be beneficial for you. And if you look at, for example, like Finnish people, they will tend to alternate a cold plunge with a sauna.
Yeah.
And what I see happening is people who live in temperate climates, who I've heard that cold plunges are good, mm-hmm. and they are actually, you know, they're doing themselves a lot of harm. You know, it's just physics. It's not personal. Like the cold doesn't care, you know, and the hot doesn't care, and you're alive and you're in it. And so it's really, yeah, really about being better at asking the questions like, okay, who's this going to be helpful for? And we can run experiments as well. We can use those questions as a starting point for like, is this likely going to be a good direction to go in? And for you, like, yeah, you know, you're super active, you're somewhere hot, your condition's worse for heat. There's all sorts of reasons why that's like a good thing for you to try. Mm-hmm. Whereas for other people, it's like, there's reasons not to try that right now. You know, you have to be at a certain level of health to be able to counteract the effects of cold, you know?
Yeah.
So for some people, And then that kind of goes into one of your, I think one of your favorite questions about hormesis, right? That for some people, going into a cold plunge, for example, or, you know, exercise or all these other hormetic stressors, but it's going to trigger a response in the body that's going to increase health. Mm-hmm. But for other people, it's going to, you know, decrease integration. It's going to make things worse. And so it's about getting more discerning being able to be like, okay, so when is this likely going to be helpful? When should we try this? How do we know if it's working? That sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think, where should we go from here? You know, there's one thing you said that's an interesting idea, which is you said in passing that some people might be aging too slowly, you know, wherever that there's so much focus on people aging too quickly and how do we slow down aging, but that there's a subset of people who are, from your perspective, aging too slowly. What does that mean?
Yeah, so that's a little bit of a jumping off point into looking at something called polyvagal theory, perhaps, you know, so maybe some of your listeners are familiar with it and some of them are not. But just to give a little background, most of us tend to think, if we think about it at all, of the nervous system having kind of a gas and a brake, you know, so the sympathetic system would be the gas and that's associated with stress. And the parasympathetic nervous system would be associated with the brake and that would be calming us down. And so then it follows that a lot of the advice is that that we're all too stressed and we're too hot and we just need more brake and to calm down. But it's a little bit more complex than that. And so there is a researcher named Stephen Porges, who's been studying heart rate variability and the vagus nerve and basically the nervous system, you know, since the 1960s. And what he found was a little bit of a paradox, which was that if your heart is beating with a little bit more dynamics to it, then that's a sign of health. And it's a sign that your vagus nerve is working a little bit stronger. But when he was doing research in the neonatal intensive care unit, I think in the 1970s and 80s, as babies became more distressed and were kind of entering more of a danger zone, their heart rate went from very fast to very slow, where there was a danger that it might stop, but also that they were able to tell that the vagal tone was actually increased, not decreased, and that that kind of variation was increased and not decreased. And so this was a bit of a paradox, and that led him to explore and really realize that the vagus nerve has two components to it. And this is also based on evolutionary biology, and I'm not going to kind of dive too deeply into that right now, but it's kind of an important first principles part of our understanding, that we have a gas pedal, which is the sympathetic nervous system, but we have two brakes. We have a gentle brake and an emergency brake. And so the gentle brake and connection and relaxation and all these good things, but the emergency brake is, you know, triggered based on life threat, and it's related to going into winter metabolism, and that will cause you to age more slowly because you're in a bit of a suspended animation, but it's a, I would say, pretty terrible quality of life. You know, it's you can feel dissociated, your body's breaking down. It's really just a last resort. But that would lead someone to age more slowly. That would lead someone to look better on labs because they are exhibiting in many ways the opposite of what they're looking for, which is all of these inflammatory metabolic diseases.
Mm. Fascinating. Mel, I wonder if this might be the best place to leave it for today. I know we have a lot more to explore, particularly resting heart rate and heart rate variability, which ties into what you were just talking about with polyvagal theory there. And I suspect probably hours more of content that we could discuss. Let's do a part two, and we'll reconnect in a few days and pick up where we left off, and we'll release these as two podcasts, and who knows, maybe a third one will follow. But let's keep exploring. I'm fascinated by your paradigm and your way of looking at human health. So I'd love to keep exploring this with you. Does that sound good?
I'd love that.
Wonderful. Awesome. Well, thank you so much. This was a fascinating discussion, and I look forward to catching up with you again in a few days.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
And one last thing, Mel, let people know where they can find you if they're interested in working with you, getting in touch with you, your services, products, anything like that.
Sure. So I'm doing, most of my work where I'm helping people is over at synthesishealth.co. Did I get that right? Synthesishealthlab.co. And I have two groups. So one is for people with complex chronic illness. I help people all over the world. It's a fantastic group program. It's really cool. And you can come in for free, actually, for a little while, hang out, ask me any questions about your health before deciding if you want long-term mentorship. And then I have a second group for practitioners. And those are for people who want to learn how to use this in practice, but also there is actually a significant number of practitioners with their own health problems who have struggled to figure out where to go. And so it's really for people, like me a few years ago, to get themselves healthy and learn these first principles, and so that they can be a healthier version of themselves and apply what they're learning to their practice.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. I'll send you an email and we'll figure out the next time to connect for part two.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mel.
Hey there, this is Ari again. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, if you found it valuable, please share it with your friends, share it with your family, help me get the word out there. Also, if you're on YouTube, make sure to hit the subscribe button and hit that little bell to get notifications every time we release a new video or new episode of the podcast. And if you're listening to this, make sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. Thanks so much for supporting my work at the Energy Blueprint. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I will see you in the next.